It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, condescending liberals. Good morning to you who think that listening to radio is the same as thinking. Good morning. How are you, progressive utopians with no sense of humor? Reaching for the dial. Stop! Wait a minute. We've got good stuff. Good morning to you, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
How you doing, man?
I worked out yesterday.
You did.
I worked out, and while I was on the bicycle, I see on the TV screen that the Pope had been chosen.
Yes, he had. The Pope has been chosen.
But see, it wasn't yet. They didn't know who it was yet.
Yeah, because maybe the smoke is not the best way to figure things out. It shouldn't be a question.
Well, it was a question because people couldn't tell whether it was white smoke, gray smoke, black smoke,
exactly,
or whatever kind of smoke it was.
Sure.
And, you know, there's nothing worse than watching a television network when they have to fill time before they get a piece of information. Because they didn't know. They had a whole bunch of people lined up to talk, but nobody could say because they didn't know yet that it was wrapped.
Hold on. It looks like the smoke has changed. No. Well, who might be the Pope? That's what was going on.
Well, there was at least one network, American network, that said that the smoke that turned out to be white was actually black, and they had not chosen a Pope. It wasn't until about a half hour later, I think, or maybe 15 minutes later, one official Italian newspaper came out and said that it was, in fact, white smoke and that the Pope had been chosen. There was a great deal of confusion at first.
Well, you know, I guess the Pope cam or the little chimney cam was not as effective as they thought it might be. It's sad when, you know, you spend 3 days looking at a rusty old chimney that when the moment actually happens, it's not clear. And there the chimney was for 3 days. We're going to talk about the Pope in a second. I was watching Hotel Rwanda last night. I rented it.
Ah.
And I watched about half of it, and it haunted me, Riley, because, oddly, maybe I'm the only one, but I see parallels in what happened there in terms of, you know, political ideology and the way things change, the way neighbors all of a sudden become your enemy, the way that people who think that they're not in the line of fire will just say, hey, if it's not in my house, I mean, if it's not my family, then it doesn't really affect me. You know, I started to really get sad about the Christian right, about the evangelicals, about this mega church meeting on Sunday against the judiciary wing of the United States government. I started to think that I asked myself, what is worse, you know, to be, you know, is it worse to be anti-Christian or is it worse to be anti-American? You know, because I see that this is an exclusionary group that wants to overthrow the government. I really believe this, and I believe it even more now, you know?
When it comes to Hotel Rwanda, I haven't seen the movie, but I did cover the story, you know, when it happened. And the one thing that struck me about that story was the use of the medium that we are now working in.
Well, they're doing it again. I mean, in this country, you know, the right wing is utilizing this medium to put through talking points. And certainly in this this big Justice Sunday thing, it's going out to 1,000 churches over the weekend. But the thing that frightens me, and obviously there is no comparison because so many lives were lost and it was a brutal massacre. Yeah. But the ideological thing that really kills me is that, you know, in Germany you had the good German. That was the German who aligned themselves with the Nazis because they thought that was the German thing to do. And now you have Republicans, just sort of rank-and-file cats who are walking down the street that believe in fiscal conservatism, they believe in Republican principles, and are not really, you know, sounding an alarm that they are aligned with a radical extremist group that wants to usurp the judiciary to put religious fascism, theocracy, into function here. And they're just sort of like, hey, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? They're, you know, it's not – there's this idea that something really awful couldn't happen here. And they are fundamentally anti-American. And I don't want to be anti-Christian because they accuse us of being anti-Christian, but I am anti-fascist. And I look around my neighborhood. I mean, my neighborhood is what America to me – really means. I look around Queens, you know, every day I deal with Pakistanis, I deal with Ukrainians, I deal with Egyptians, I deal with Dominicans, I deal with Italian guys.
Well, you know why?
Well,
because you live in the most diverse county in America.
And that's just my building, Riley. You know, there are two people, a couple of people from Chicago downstairs. Right, but to me, there is no, that is what it's supposed to be. These are people that come here because they have the freedom to be who they want to be, to practice the religion they want, you know, under, you know, the protection of this great democracy, which is what it's about. I see what's going on Sunday, Justice Sunday, the Christo-fascist zombie brigades. I see this as being limiting, as being exclusionary, as being totalitarian in its intent, and it really bothers me because we've been talking about this for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now people are all of a sudden starting to say, well, maybe this is something. Maybe, you know, we used to get calls from Christians. It's like, don't knock Christians. We're not knocking Christians. And the Pope, you know, that we have this conservative Pope who was in the Nazi youth. And I don't care what anybody says. When you're 14 years old and you're involved in anything, whether it's compulsory or not, it's going to have an impact on your life. And if you look at this guy's policies or whatever you call, you know, papal dictates, you know, he is a very exclusionary guy. He's a bigot in a lot of ways, and it's a radical Catholicism in the terms of that. I look at something radical as being arcane. If you want to, you know, commit to arcane principles, medieval principles in this day and age, what are you being? That's radical.
Well, see, the interesting thing about Pope Benedict the 16th is that he took the name of one pope who was a great reformer in mm-hmm. the Catholic Church. But he is and was actually Pope John Paul's pit bull on church doctrine. He has opposed women becoming members of the Catholic clergy. He has opposed any movement on many issues that American Catholics have as a primary concern. The thing with him is his elevation is now being hailed throughout the Catholic Church in Africa, which is a very fast-growing church, because they are very, very conservative. They have to be in order to balance their situation with fundamentalist Islam, where, and in Africa, that's who the Catholics are competing with.
Well, we'll go, when we come back after the break, we'll go nuts and bolts into, you know, each element of the new Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th. You know, even to, you know, some people are deconstructing why he took that name. He obviously has a history in the Vatican. He was the enforcer,
yes,
as you said, for Pope John. He was in charge of the office that used to be called the Inquisition.
He didn't even want the liturgy to be done in a language other than Latin. He got very upset years ago when they made that change in the church.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, this is a traditionalist. And his elevation sends a very clear signal to Catholics all over the world. We could talk about that.
Yeah, we will. And I just, like, it concerns me because I think that going back to, you know, what was to medieval practices, to Orthodox practices, even whether it's Jewish or Muslim, whatever it is, when you are going back to, you know, the sort of roots of the religion in terms of you know, Latin masses, it's exclusionary. It's just exclusionary, and it doesn't function for people in the modern world. It makes it this cryptic, weird thing that has to be done in a rigid way. There's no room for any sort of breathing or any sort of compromise, and this is going to be the downfall of the modern world, is people sort of latching on to arcane methodology.
Well, this Pope has said that he is going to stick to traditional church doctrine, and people who are not with that doctrine can leave.
Right.
I mean, that's essentially the position he's taken.
We were actually able to get a secret recording from, you know, from Cardinal Mort Milfington. Had a friend who was in the Vatican voting, and he was able to sneak out a mini disc recording of actually the process of the vote. And we're happy to have this exclusive here on Morning's Edition. We'll play that for you when we come back. It's 15 past the hour. Good morning. It's Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Mike Mills from REM, and you are listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio.
Our estate variation. Call American Life, 1-866-492-2500. That's 1-866-492-2500.
Hey, it's 19 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. You know, the entire world's attention was on Rome yesterday as a new pope was chosen. And we have something pretty special for you. Morning Sedition was able to get a microphone in the chamber where the College of Cardinals was meeting to decide who will be the next pope. You know, they need 2/3 majority. Do you know that?
Oh, yeah.
So they still honor the way it should work here in the Senate, that the Christian right is, you know, fighting so so hardly against. They still require two-thirds majority. They still have the opportunity to filibuster, I guess.
Yeah.
This is one of the oldest religious institutions in the world. I don't even know why I'm all of a sudden siding with them. Pick a side, Maron. All right, so this may be the first time in history that the actual process was captured on tape, and I'm very excited about this. Let's share that with them, Kayla.
Gentlemen, if I may have your attention, please. P as in Paul, 6. P, 6. Next. O, 15. Oh, you know, I like it. Old Testament, 15. O, 15. Here it comes, the next ping pong ball. E as in Ecclesiastes, 8.
Hey, I got a pope here. Everybody, I'm in a new pope.
Okay, bring up your card, Giuseppe. Let me check your numbers. She's looking good. Oh, we got a new pope. Somebody drink up the white smoke.
No one ever knew that when they're behind closed doors, not only do they all speak in Italian accents, but they all sound exactly like Chico Marx.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising, but when you learn stuff like that. Now, look, first of all, I just want to say that nearly three-quarters of American Catholics say that they are more likely to follow their own conscience on difficult moral questions rather than the teachings of Pope Benedict the 16th, and that's according to a new CNN USA Today Gallup poll, as it has been the case with American Catholics, I think, for a long time. Now, the odd thing to me, Riley, is this guy who was the head of the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, which this is the Vatican office, charged with preserving the purity of Catholic doctrine. It is actually the successor to the office, to the Inquisition. So this guy is in charge of this for Pope John.
Yes.
John Paul. He's the hard-line guy. He's the guy that manages the moral sort of restrictions of papal doctrine.
Is there such a thing as a theological ideologue? I guess so.
Sure.
Well, he's one.
All right. Well, dig this in. So how come, why is it in 2004 that we had the second largest number of allegations for any year on record of sexual abuse by members of the church? 1,083 people reported to civil or church authorities that they had been sexually abused as children by Roman Catholic priests. Authorities received allegations against 756 priests and deacons. Half had been previously named in similar accusations. The church temporarily removed more than 300 clergy members and permanently defrocked 148. About 80% of the victims who came forward were male. The majority said they were between the ages of 10 and 14 when abuse began. Most of the alleged incidents took place in the 60s and 70s. Now, our new pope instructed bishops to continue covering up sexual abuse. Isn't that right, Riley?
Well, in 1962, the Vatican sent a letter to every Catholic bishop on the planet that had a policy that talked about a policy of the strictest secrecy in dealing with sexual abuse allegations, and it even went so far as to threaten people who spoke out with excommunication. Now, in May 2001, Cardinal Ratzinger sent a letter to all the bishops in the world at that time saying that the 1962 order was still in effect.
So this is a guy, Mr. Morality, all right, Mr., the moral standard for the Catholic Church, basically said, look, we're going to maintain this policy, this secret policy of denial, of avoidance, of, you know, basically aiding and abetting child sexual abuse, certainly here within the American Catholic Church. I'm curious if you're Catholic out there, because I it's been rumored that there are progressive Catholics. 866-303-2270 is our number if you'd like to say something about the new pope. Let's talk a little bit more about what this guy stands for, Riley.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's going to have, I think, a very, very strong effect on the Catholic Church's relations with other Christian religions is this new pope's proclamation. This is in 2000. It's only 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the Roman Catholic Church is, quote, the one true church of Jesus Christ, and branded other denominations as, quoting here, deficient. That's a problem. If you're going to work with evangelicals, if you're going to work with other religions, how are you going to do that if you are on record publicly as saying that these other denominations are somehow deficient?
Yeah,
that's a very serious problem. Now, here's a couple of things about this guy, Mark, that people need to be clear about. One, he just turned 78. That means he knows going in that his reign as Pope is going to be relatively short, certainly compared to Pope John Paul's reign. That means that whatever he's going to do, he's going to be looking to do it very, very quickly. Another thing, there are and apparently was a block of cardinals at this conclave who did not want Pope Benedict the 16th. And here's a quote from one, Cardinal Godfrey Danyels of Belgium, who had been openly critical of Ratzinger as cardinal. And he said he didn't disclose his own vote, and he didn't criticize Cardinal Ratzinger directly. But one thing he said that was very telling, he talked about the name Benedict, because Benedict was a man of peace and reconciliation during the First World War. And he said, and this is Cardinal Danyel saying, quote, "We have to see what's in a name." It's some very, very telling. Not everybody's on board with this. And as you point out, Mark, the Catholic Church in the United States has been willing, and I shouldn't say the church, individual Catholics have been cherry-picking what they follow of Catholic doctrine for some time now, so certainly for the last half century.
Well, what you talked about yesterday and what we were going to talk a little bit about today was that they may be cutting their losses with the American Catholic Church in the sense that they may be looking south, they may be looking to Africa, to Central America, where you say that this rigid form of Catholicism, this arcane and seemingly narrow, not seemingly, a version of ancient Catholicism is going to be very useful and very attractive to the Catholic priests of Africa, of Central America?
Not so much of Central America. Central America's got a different situation. They are in Central and South America, the Catholic Church was involved in what was called liberation theology. It's a decidedly leftist theology, and it was a response in many instances to military dictatorships that ran South America throughout the 60s and 70s.
And this guy was against that.
He was against that. In fact, he was the leader of the movement within the church that silenced some of these guys
for speaking out.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to Africa when we come back. Talk to Riley about that a little bit more about the new Pope's anti-gay stance, which is unique in the way that he actually sort of did what DeLay did and sort of suggested in a strange way violence against homosexuals. It's 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Tobacco. Is it any wonder that Bobby and I are taking our fight to the airways on Air America Radio? Join us every Saturday on Ring of Fire.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's Air America Radio's Morning Tradition. In just a few minutes, we are going to hear our first part of an interview we did yesterday with filmmaker Dan Cloris to discuss his new documentary. He's discussing his new documentary, Ring of Fire, the Emile Griffith story, about a 1962 boxing match in which Emile Griffith killed Benny Parrott after Parrott called Griffith gay. It's an incredible little documentary that's really worth seeing. But right now, we are taking calls about the new Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th, who was in the Nazi youth. Anyways, yeah, look at me.
Hitler youth.
Well, let me just simplify things. No, he's...
he was conscripted now, let's be fair.
Whatever. But he's very conservative and has been for a long time. Let's just take a couple of calls. Sheila and New Rochelle, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. Thank you.
Hi, Sheila.
What do you have to say about your new pope?
Well, I have two comments. One, Orwellian names and titles are everywhere right now.
Mm-hmm.
And two, the Latin American and African cardinals are not as happy with U.S. policy in their continents. This man will do the United States well because the American money carries the Catholic Church more so than it carries the U.N.
That's interesting because, you know, the Catholic Church took about close to $1 billion hit in lawsuits because of child sexual abuse in the last couple of years. I'd be curious to know where you got your numbers, and I'd certainly...
No, she's right. She's right. A lot of that settlement money came directly out of the pockets of American Catholics. One of the reasons why they really have not wanted up until now to alienate either American or European Catholics is that's where the money's coming from. That's where the funds are coming to actually deal with a lot of the missions that they do in other parts of the world. That's historic in the Catholic.
But as a Catholic, Sheila, I mean, what are your personal feelings about following this guy spiritually, about his doctrine, about what he represents?
Well, I don't adhere to most Catholic policies, particularly birth control. They will not mention birth control because the money comes from our pockets. I also disagree about homosexuality because I believe Jesus was a gay man. So I don't go along with them, but I'm Catholic. But
that's way far away from church doctrine,
I understand. That's about a half a block from church doctrine.
What's the difference between birth control and having gay sex?
Is this a joke?
Of course not. I'm Catholic.
Oh.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's funny because...
The children is the only reason to indulge in that activity.
Okay.
That's a very good point.
That's old school. You know,
yeah.
That was before.
I am much, much younger.
Yes. I mean, that's before people were able to have fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting
because Bishop Eugene Robinson,
my church, from the Episcopal Church, caught a lot of heat for supposedly implying, and we had to debunk that, that Jesus was gay.
Well, you know, the basement of the Vatican holds a lot of secrets. There's always there's supposedly ancient texts. There's pieces of Jesus down there. There's, and obviously there's a tremendous amount of denial about how much homosexuality there is among the clergy, and there was a tremendous attempt to cover up the sexual abuse. I mean, there might be a document in the basement of the Vatican, a love letter between Jesus and one of the apostles. Mary, in Italy, streaming. How are you, Mary?
Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, I found your website and clicked on this morning and couldn't believe that you were talking about a subject that happens to just be very vibrant where I am right now. One of my comments is that I concur with the premise that the church is going to go into Africa and Latin America, although more strongly into the African continent, to look for converts. But I think the money is a conundrum. But I also believe, and there's speculation over here, that there's very much a treasure trove, literally, in the Vatican. And there's a whole lot of money that can be liquidated through a lot of the artworks and different things. And if they decide to turn their back de facto on the United States as far as a cash cow, that so be it, because the Vatican can float on its own. Now, that's the speculation in the Italian press, but they are saying that pretty much Ratzinger will be turning his back on his U.S. constituency because he doesn't believe that they follow the hardline doctrine that he wants to implement, and so he's looking for greener pastures, so to speak.
Wow, interesting.
I've seen those same reports here in the States.
Thanks, Mary.
Ratzinger is prepared, or I should say Pope Benedict the 16th, let's be fair, that he is really looking to make Catholics around the world hew to church doctrine, and you know, if there are segments of the church that don't want to do that, fine. He's willing to deal with a much smaller Catholic church around the world as long as they follow church doctrine.
Yeah, it's the orthodoxy, the arcane methods, the restrictions. We'll talk more about it later. Right now, we want to talk to filmmaker Dan Corris. He joined us yesterday for a discussion about Ring of Fire, the Emil Griffith story, which is going to be on USA Tonight, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
It's a very worthwhile documentary. Right now, we're going to share the first part of our conversation with Dan Corris from yesterday. We're talking to Dan Corris, who is the director of Ring of Fire, the Emil Griffith story. It airs tonight on the USA Network. Now, what drew you to this story originally? Now, I got to be, before you answer that, let me just say, Dan, I am 41 years old, and I feel like I know things about some things. I've seen, I'm fairly awake, but I knew nothing of this man. I knew nothing of his story, and I'm a little ashamed of that. So why don't you tell me how you were drawn to it?
Well, you're a baby at 41, which is great.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I hear you're a baby in general, but not
okay. Yes, I've heard that as well. You been reading our emails? All right, go ahead.
I was 12 years old, Mark. I watched the fight on television.
Wow, you're an old man.
I was a big Friday Night Fight fan. You know, that was a big thing. It was like Monday Night Football today.
Yeah.
And I've been watching the Friday Night Fight since I was about 9 years old. So even at 12, you realize there's something dramatically wrong. You knew that the fight should have been stopped, and you had never seen anyone carried out of the ring in a stretcher. And you got to school that Monday morning, and you learned a new word, coma. didn't know what that meant. And then all anyone ever spoke about, there were two debates in those days. Should we have fallout shelters and should boxing be abolished?
But in the context of this film, though, you know, you really go into, I had no idea who this guy was. He was a great boxer, Emil Griffith, and this Benny Perrette was also a big boxer at the time. And this was something that, you know, went on every couple months. Boxing was a huge sport. Everybody watched it. And that's interesting that you say the fight should be stopped, because when I watched it, I found it to be difficult to tell.
Yeah, well, it shook the world. The world, literally. Everyone from the Vatican to the London Parliament to the New York Times editorial board to Governor Rockefeller to every hack politician to a young Howard Cosell got on their stump and called for a ban on boxing. And that I was very aware of. And even then, there was a little whisper, didn't know what it meant then, that Emil Griffith, the world champion, was gay. But the film goes into all the mitigating circumstances. Perrette, an exile from Cuba, had been badly beaten for five fights before that.
Five consecutive fights.
So you're saying that there is a real good case to be made that he shouldn't have been fighting.
Absolutely.
After he'd been through such a string of harsh fights. And for people don't know, this story is revolving around Emil Griffith, killing this guy. That he went into a coma after the fight, and even in the footage that you have that I guess you must have seen when you were a kid, you know, they're trying to say, and the winner is, but they can't even do that because they're pulling this guy out on a stretcher, which had never happened before. But also, what's very important and crucial to the film that you made is that Emil Griffith was not known to be this violent a fighter. And there is some, your film presents the idea that the reason he was so hostile at that moment and so violent was because of something that was said about him.
Well, it's a significant issue. At the weigh-in, in those days the weigh-ins weren't the extravagances of what they are today, Perrette stood behind Emil, pinched his buttocks, whispered in his ear, maricón, the Spanish word for homosexual. A slur, a derogatory comment, more importantly, a humiliation. And when we're humiliated, we act out.
Hey, you know, the film, you know, I stop saying, you know, Mark, Dan Cloris made an interesting and impactful documentary with Ring of Fire, the Emil Griffith story, and I watched the entire thing yesterday, and you remember when you were a kid, right?
I was a kid. I did not see it like Dan Cloris did. I listened to it.
We're live now, by the way.
Oh, yes. No, I listened to it on the radio, and it was one of those things that scared me, literally scared me out of a year's growth. That, and I think it was that same year, or maybe the year after, they executed a guy in New York. It was the last guy that was executed in New York State. And I remember reading and counting. Those are the two things I used to have nightmares about as a kid.
Really? I watched the footage in The Ring of Fire, and I'll tell you something. There's a moment where that guy goes down, where Benny Perrette goes down, and you're like, oh, my God. And because that TV was such a new medium and that, the way he goes down and the way that it was handled, which was not graceful because they didn't have it. They kept going to the long shot where they're raising Emil Griffith's arm up, yet this guy, they're trying to revive a guy in the ring. Brutal stuff. We'll talk to, we'll hear the rest of our interview with Dan Cloris. The film is Ring of Fire, the Emil Griffith story on tonight, USA Network, after this, 44 past the hour.
Morning Sedition.
This is the Wake Up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Experts now. 800-396-9711. 800-396-9711. That's 800-396-9711.
Nine past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I will be in Cincinnati, Ohio at Go Bananas May 6th and 7th. So all you fans listening to 1530 WCKY, the revolution of talk radio, come on down. Check it out. Go to morningsedition.com for details. We are in the middle of an interview we did yesterday with Dan Cloris, who is discussing his new documentary, Ring of Fire, the Emil Griffith story. He was just leaving off or starting to talk about the weigh-in, which is where some comments were made by Benny Perrette, who lost his life because of this fight, to Emil Griffith about his sexuality. And this was unusual, as Chorus was saying, to have this kind of stuff go on in a way, and it was not what it is like today. So let's re-enter that interview there, Chris.
At the weigh-in, in those days the weigh-ins were on the extravagances of what they are today, Perrette stood behind Emil, pinched his buttocks, whispered in his ear, maricón, the Spanish word for homosexual, a slur, a derogatory comment, more importantly, a humiliation. And when we're humiliated, we act out. We get angry. It doesn't matter what it is. Griffith lunged at Perrette at the weigh-in. Highly unusual for the time. This is not the Mike Tyson era, you know? So when he got into the ring, though, it was a brutal fight in the 12th, and he said he was angry going into the ring. Did that humiliation and that anger have an effect on him when he hit him 25 to 28 times in a row in the head in the 12th round, lower left-hand corner of your television screen? It's almost impossible to determine. He was angry in the ring. Was he a well-trained executioner during that barrage, or was something of that humiliation in his head? He can't answer it.
It was mind-blowing to watch it. I mean, it was disturbing. I mean, when he went down, I mean, I couldn't tell. I mean, you know, I don't watch fighting. I'm not a big boxing fan. So it looked to me like a fight was going on. But the way that, you know, when he was up on the ropes and the punches kept coming, and then the way he just drifted down the side, it was nauseating. I mean, as a watcher now, to watch this event and to see it repeated over and over again, and then to see them try to maintain some decorum in the ring when this guy, he's clearly, as you said, that even when Emil Griffith comes over, there's that moment where he knew, too, that something was definitely wrong.
And the handlers whisked Griffith away.
You have the likes of Jimmy Breslin, Pete Hamill, Jack Newfield, some of the best writers of their generation followed this story. Talk a little bit about what it was like to get them to recollect that night.
They had pretty clear recollections, but what I wanted from Hamill was not merely that night, but I wanted him to describe New York in the late 50s, early 60s, mm-hmm. which I think he did marvelously,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Definitely. Yeah.
And Breslin, you know, it was so interesting about Breslin because of his, you know, he had a major brain operation himself. So getting Breslin to talk about, you know, the effects of a blow on the brain, you know.
Yeah.
And still using that, he has that language, like the gaze, he said.
That's right. Yeah. But what they were really great at, which I didn't remember, and the same thing with Charlie Stewart, the gay historian, I had forgotten how ostracized, how never spoken about gay life was at this time, even in New York. Breslin's right. Three gays on a corner, you get arrested.
Yeah,
New York Times files, the guy from the New York Times files his initial report from the weigh-in, because there's an early edition, comes out 10, 11 o'clock at night, uses the word homosexual, the copy desk changes it, according to Hamill, which is correct, to unmanned. Wouldn't even print the word homosexual in the newspaper.
Now, Emil Griffith, you know, never to this day apparently has really admitted that he's gay, per se. He married for a brief period of time. And even now in today's sports, even in today's films, this is a stigma that is beyond all stigmas. There is nobody out. It is still the great unspoken thing. And this, you know, I don't want to give away the movie at all because it's a very compelling, very tremendous document of the type of, it's not even a frustration, just the type of self-censorship that came, you know, second nature to people that were in this predicament.
Yes, little has changed since 1962 in the sense of homosexuality in the world of sport. There's not one male gay athlete in any major professional sport in America today who has ever come out while they're playing, ever.
Now, Emil Griffith, what was it like to talk? Was it difficult to get him to talk about that time?
Well, first, I met Emil about 2 years ago when I started, and even at that time, he suffers from significant brain damage from when he was a victim of a hate crime in 1992.
Isn't that unbelievable? It's a demonic irony.
Right.
That he was beat up by a group of, I don't know how old they were, but it was a group of gay bashers,
right.
who just set out to kill the guy.
That's right. They almost killed him.
Were they ever brought to justice?
No, never captured. You know, four, perhaps five guys with a baseball bat.
Oh.
With a baseball bat. Rolled them out of a gay bar in, at 3 in the morning, August or late July 1992. So I spent 3 days, probably about 15, 16 hours interviewing Emil. And I needed the help of his adopted son at my side to help focus him. So at that point, he comes in and out of moments of clarity. In the last year and a half, it's significantly worse. Significantly worse. He's deteriorated even more. So you never know when he's speaking in sound bites or, you know, the language of to protect himself, you know. But clearly, he was haunted, regretful. And he said something very interesting the first time I brought it up, and I didn't sit down and say, hey, you know, it took hours to get there. He called it his accident. And at first I was stunned. I was intrigued by that. And I said to Bud Schulberg later on, who I interviewed, I said, Emil called it his accident. Isn't that weird? And Schulberg, at that time, 89, looked at me like dope. It was an accident to him.
And there's a profound resolution to the sort of burden that he was carrying at the end of this film, and I recommend that people watch it. It's going to be on tonight on the USA Network. Dan Cloris, it was a pleasure to talk to you. What a great piece of work.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate being here. You
know, okay.
Good to be here.
Okay, we're back live. Isn't it interesting? I'm hearing myself. I sort of got a little bit of a New York accent talking to him. Because his is so extreme. I start, and I start doing that. I've got this Zelig-y kind of quality. Here's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. One, sue the Vatican for your ingestion of secondhand Pope-electing smoke. Two, propose that the 2012 Olympics be held in cyberspace. No potential host city's feelings will get hurt, and it's so much better for the environment. Three, praise government for getting rid of the new food pyramid because that glorified slave-built monuments. Plus, it's rainbow-colored. I don't know. Four, go to the steps of the new Lincoln Museum and shout, Abe was the last Eastern Republican president, and he was way gayer than Reagan. Five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Hey, Senate, nice going on delaying the Bolton confirmation. Too bad you didn't have any nads when it came to confirming Condi or Gonzalez or anyone else from the neocon death cult army. Wake up, sheeple. The horse is out of the barn, man.
We're going to talk about that next hour because
the Bolton vote
has been delayed, and we'll tell you why and who delayed it.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of delays,
there's
a contest on about a billboard for Tom Delay.
In his own district.
We'll get to all of that when we come back here on Air America Radio. Blah, 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 blah.
That's right. 6 past the hour, morning's edition here with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Hi.
You're listening to Air America Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians. You know, Riley, I went into Marino's Fish yesterday. I hadn't been there in a few days.
Uh-oh.
And they figured out that whenever my wife's in town, I don't apparently come in and buy anything. And they said I looked happier. And they said that someone came in and said, is this the Marino's Fish that they talk about on Air America?
And he's so like, you're bringing the business now.
Well, I guess, but
you
I
want to cut?
Yeah, sure. Well, no, a piece of fish every once in a while wouldn't be bad. I picked up my snapper yesterday. But the funny thing is literally, these guys were guys that I thought I just automatically assumed, you know, would not ever listen to our show. And they're digging it. They like the show. And there's apparently a lot of people out in Astoria that are digging the show. And I'm very excited about that.
Hey, Astoria.
Yeah, I've really grown to love my neighborhood, man. It's just such a unique, eclectic, weird place. I was on the phone being interviewed by some woman in Los Angeles.
Uh-oh.
And she was asking me about the transition when you move from New York to L.A. or you're doing the bi-coastal thing, which I'm really not anymore. I'm pretty much back here in New York. Is that, you know, I'm on the phone with her and I'm looking out my window and I'm looking at the people walking by in Astoria. And I said, right now I see hundreds of people walking by my window down 30th Avenue in Astoria. And you know what? Probably 99% of them want nothing to do with show business. Al, you're never going to happen in Los Angeles. That is never going to happen in Los Angeles. Okay, what I want to get into right now is, I'm going to be in Cincinnati May 6th and 7th. If you're listening to 1530 WCKY, the Revolution of Talk Radio, I'll be at Go Bananas that weekend. Come on down. I already got an email that somebody's going to drive 7 hours. Come to the show, which is very exciting.
You better be good.
I'll be good 3 out of 4. No, I'm going to be good. Come on. So now let's get into to John Bolton a little bit, talking about apparently Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, said yesterday there is no need for delay. And three Republicans agreed with him and said, yeah, let's get back to talking about Bolton. So, but apparently, hello, there you go. How are you? Is this on? Here we go. But this is good news. I just sound like Springer. What am I doing? All right. This is good news, people. The judiciary should work like
first
this.
First it was Al Franken. And
it's
was
awful. How can they do that? I don't know. All right. Anyways, here we go. I am very impressed that that Voinovich from Ohio, the
Senator George Voinovich,
has been moved. Apparently, he missed the first part of the hearings. He came in, he heard Biden speak, he heard a couple other speakers.
Chris Dodd from Connecticut.
Chris Dodd, yeah. And he said, you know what, I'm not on board with this. And this is another example of a Republican who's not being the good Republican, like the good German, just towing the party line because he feels like he has to. This is actually government working the way it's supposed to work.
You know, I mentioned on the air when they first started taking up Bolton's nomination that I thought George Voinovich might be one Republican senator who would waver on this, only because I knew a little bit about his voting record, and I knew a little bit about his record as mayor of Cleveland and as governor of Ohio. But until yesterday, nobody on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee thought George Voinovich was off the ranch. And Dick Lugar, the chair of the committee from Indiana, had decided to start setting the vote. This was after Biden spoke. This was after Dodd spoke. They had blown away any opposition on the part of the Democrats. And all of a sudden, here comes George Voinovich saying, whoa, hold it. I'm not doing this. Now it's put off until May 1st. This is significant because whatever happens, two things are going to happen. This is in one of the reports that we read this morning. Either a Republican attack machine is going to go after one of their own and start leaking unpleasant details about George Voinovich, or more unpleasant details about Bolton are going to come out between now and May 1st, and that will have the effect of dooming his nomination.
And this is not Voinovich is not a guy. He's a guy that's gone against Bush's before.
On many different occasions, yes.
So, you know, he speaks his mind, he speaks his values, and his values don't agree with this. I mean, he basically, let's hear that what he had to say at the Bolton hearings yesterday.
I've heard enough today that I don't feel comfortable about voting for Mr. Bolton. I think one's interpersonal skills and their relationship with their fellow man is a very important ingredient in anyone that works for me. I call it the kitchen test. Do we feel comfortable about the kitchen test?
It's a new question.
And I've heard enough today that gives me some real concern about Mr. Bolton.
Yeah, I think I would fail the kitchen test. I mean, I've seen the HBO special. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm trying to get better, but then again, I'm not up for UN ambassador. I'm a radio talk show host. But I like the fact that this is the Senate working the way it's supposed to work, that the government should check itself. That's why these are put into place. That's why checks and balances are there. There should be two parties, not just one neocon death cult dictating through coercion, bribes, and fear how every senator of Republican ilk should vote.
You know, one of the things that seems to be coming out now are reports in some of the press that the Bush administration might be getting ready to bail on John Bolton, that there are some elements within the Bush cabinet, specifically Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who, remember, is now Bolton's immediate supervisor. He's still in the State Department.
Right.
And apparently, Bolton's relationship with Dick Cheney has made Condoleezza Rice nervous. She's afraid that if Bolton's confirmed, Bolton's going to run back to Cheney reporting about her.
Okay, so you're also speculating on the break that there is some buzz that if given that we now get 3 weeks more to talk about this guy and they're bringing more people in to talk about this guy, that the president himself, might detach himself from the process.
Yeah, I mean, look, if this trickle turns into a stream and then turns into a river, Bolton is done. I mean, on that level. Now, the question is, will there be more people that come out? This woman that talked about the whole Moscow hotel incident is fairly recent. Will there be other people who will now stand up and come out and say, you know what, this guy was absolutely awful. Remember, you're not talking about somebody leading a bunch of troops someplace. If he wanted to be the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or if he wanted to go over to Iraq and lead some troops, fine. This is a diplomatic post he's up for.
And there's a price to pay for being a hole.
You
know,
yes,
I mean,
there's
just there. I know it from personal experience. I know it from familial experience. You know, my dad is a recovering hole. And
see,
you know,
if you
are that, eventually it will catch up with you. There's, you know, for everybody that thinks that you're impressive because of your disposition and that you get things done, there's going to be a lot of people saying, "Yeah, I know that guy. That guy's a hole." And they're going to wait for their moment to take you down. And I hope to hell that they take this guy down, because you do need, if he's going to be the head diplomat of this country, you do need to be diplomatic, and you do need to be able to compromise and have discussions in a meaningful way with people from other countries that are proactive.
Yeah. Now, George Voinovich, for people who aren't familiar with his record, he is a deficit hawk. He voted against, or actually was in opposition to, President Bush's tax cuts until he got a cap of $350 billion on it. That was his decision. He was the one that held out for that, and then he was successful. Apparently, he is eighth among Senate Republicans in breaking ranks with the party's doctrine. He does it about 12% of the time. When he was in Ohio as governor of the state and also mayor of Cleveland, he was unique in that he managed as a Republican to get very high numbers among blacks in the state of Ohio, sometimes as high as 42-44% of the black vote when he was running Cleveland and when he was running the state. So he's an interesting guy, and if he holds fast, he may draw like Lincoln Chafee and Chuck Hagel and some of these other wavering Republicans to his side like a magnet, and then Bolton's doomed.
This is very exciting. I'm trying to get excited like you do about this political process.
Oh, I love this stuff.
I know, yeah, and I'm
this is some funny stuff.
I am excited in terms of the possibility of Bolton going down, but I want to start to get really excited, like, you know, like people get excited about baseball. In analyzing the Senate, it's starting to happen slowly. It's good.
These are human beings. These are people, and a lot of the same stuff that drives you and me drives them. It's not all a matter of nicety. It's not all a matter of what you see on the floor, what you see in C-SPAN. There's a lot of behind the scenes, backroom kinds of stuff that goes on, that goes literally. It doesn't get outside the belt.
And also has nothing to do with caring about the American people.
Absolutely nothing to do with caring about the American people.
This is the interesting thing, because I was listening to Rachel's show. Rachel Maddow does a show, if you get it, before our show here in New York. And, you know, there are people that just lock in to politics as if it were a team sport, and it's very exciting to them. It's full of nuance and, as you're saying, you know, human elements. And I, as somebody who, since I've worked here, am starting to learn more about it and get more engaged with it, and it is very rewarding, because now I can watch the news, I can watch and talk about things like I've never been able to talk to before, and I know that our show reaches out to a lot of people like that, in that my disposition is not unlike, oddly, most Americans.
Yeah.
And getting people excited about politics is very important, to understand the rush and the thrill of how things are actually done, whether or not it's for the people or not for the people. The Beltway is what it is. It is what runs this country, for better or for worse. And we, the people, are supposed to be the ones that make the decisions of who gets to run the country. So the more people get involved with it, the better off we all are. Like Robert Rice said yesterday, if people don't get active, you know, certainly in the Democratic camp, and say, this is exciting, this is something that I want to fight for to make America a better place, then we're really, you know, we're up the creek.
Yeah,
so
literally.
Hopefully it does become compelling, and everyone listening to us isn't just some, you know, condescending wonk who listens to radio because it feels like thinking to them. It's 17 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You gotta keep them separated.
Hi, this is Reverend Barry Lynn from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, here to remind you that God and politics don't mix. That's why I get my God from the Good Book and my politics from Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mantis Tiller Cultivator. Put the fun back in gardening. Call now 1-800-211-8001. That's 1-800-211-8001.
Twenty-one past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Sarah America Radio's Morning Citizen program. In a few minutes, we'll be talking to Operation Truth founder Paul Rykoff about the recent events in Iraq in terms of how much truth is actually getting out of Iraq between roadblocks put up by the military, the press unable to cover anything, the insurgency getting more organized, and the army not engaging with the insurgents as much as it used to, is all letting them portray the war as being a success where it might not be the case. And we'll talk to Paul in just a few minutes. Right now, my therapist told me to write down my dreams. Here's last night, so I'm bringing them into him tomorrow. It's 1978, and I'm in the front row at a Ted Nugent concert. The Nuge is rocking on stage with his long hair and his loincloth. Wang dang, sweet poo, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm going out of my mind screaming, Nuge, the Nuge rocks! At the end of this song, Ted reaches out his sweaty hand to me and says, hey, little man, come on backstage, we'll hang out. And so I followed Ted Nugent backstage, and he says, let's roll. So we get in his pickup, and we're driving. He's driving like a wild man and blasting music, and pretty soon we're out in the woods. He pulls over. I say, what are we doing, Nuge? You know, I'm 14. He hands me a camouflage jumpsuit and a shotgun. He says, time for you to become a man. So I put on my jumpsuit, and I followed the Nuge into an area behind a chain-link fence. It was a petting zoo, Mark. Nuge said, look over by that bowl of birdseed. It was a baby deer, Riley. Nuge whipped out an assault rifle and cut the deer in half with four bursts. Chunks of brain and carcass flew everywhere. Yeah! Second Amendment, baby! Having fun! I'm a little nauseated. Later, we sneaked inside this huge circus tent and found a mountain lion sleeping in a cage. Ted quietly opened the cage, pulled out a Luger, and shot it in the temple. Then he pulled out a giant hunting knife and carved that lion into four perfect loincloths. He called it man clothes and insisted that we both put them on right there. I was getting really sick. Still, I made him turn around. So we went back outside, and he says, it's time for you to kill something, little scout. Kill that squirrel, Mark. It's him or you, man. I say, no, it's not. It's eating nuts, and I can just walk away. Kill it, wuss! I take a couple of steps toward the squirrel, then I pick up a piece of bark, and I throw it at him. I turn and run away as fast as I can from Ted Nugent and this culture of death. In the distance, I could hear a terrified squeaking, and then a gunshot, and then the sound of Ted Nugent biting into fresh squirrel. Ugh. I woke up, and my bed was filled with venison jerky. So dig this. Who said this, Mark Riley? Quote, the time has come that the American people know exactly what their representatives are doing here in Washington. Are they feeding at the public trough, taking lobbyists' paid vacations, getting wined and dined by special interest groups, or are they working hard to represent their constituents? The people, the American people, have a right to know. And I say the best disinfectant is full disclosure. End quote. Who said that?
George Washington?
Tom DeLay.
Oh,
1995.
Sorry.
How about a little taste of his own medicine?
Yeah.
That's what we need. Now, apparently, what's going on is there is a movement, a small movement, but a Democracy for America, that's Howard Dean's old organization, is going to put up a billboard in Tom DeLay's district. And they've got a bunch of ideas of what they want to put on their billboard. They've got a bunch of slogans. You can go to what is the, here we go. Blog at democracy, it's emailing blog at democracyforamerica.com. That's blog at democracyforamerica.com. You can see their choices. We've got a few choices. There's this stuff like, you know, nail the hammer, Tom DeLay does not represent me, don't mess with ethics. Education is not my job. That's a quote from Tom DeLay. But we've got one we want to put through, and we'd like you to put this down if you go to it. Tom DeLay, the hammer. What a tool. How about that? And there's a couple that we threw away. Here's one. If you can read this, your congressman is about to get fired. How's that one? Is that right?
Yeah.
My other congressman is not a complete douche.
Wow.
How's it feel getting screwed by a hammer? Anything?
Ooh.
Huh? All right. Sucking on your halls of Congress. Anything? Squeezing your halls of Congress. No? Mm. Nah. Kicking you in the halls of Congress. Nothing? Nah. Let's stick with Tom DeLay, the hammer. What a tool.
Yeah.
So
I
go
like that
to, okay, go to blog at democracyforamerica.com and give us, write in our suggestion. Let's see if we can make that happen. But they've also got like 40
suggestions here. You know, some of them are okay. DeLay, no longer. Tom DeLay, the hammer. What a tool.
What a tool. Let me tell you something. He's getting more and more desperate. Now he's going to conservative talk radio to, defend himself, come out with the spiel about the Democrats and the liberal media and all the rest of that. He's going to his homies. He was on, I think, Fox News Radio yesterday, spieling the usual.
Okay. Well, it's email@blog@democracyforamerica.com. It's email. It's not. It's not a website. That's confusing. So he's out doing his. He talked to Fox News yesterday. Is what you said?
Yeah, he's talking to Fox News. And again, this is in delay in full denial. I mean, this is his way of trying to get out from under. And people shouldn't let him get out from under because he doesn't deserve it.
Smokescreen with the judiciary is what he's doing.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about that later. But we got Paul Rykoff coming up next to talk about Iraq and what is and isn't happening in Iraq.
Stay with us. It's Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Right-wing media together, they make a great Al Franken show, along with the indefensible Martin Luther. Next time on Franken.
Before past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. We're going to be talking to Paul Rykoff in just a few minutes from Operation Truth. But right now, as you know, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the 5-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milvington.
Dateline, our nation's capital, named after the father of our country, George Washington. Pot smoker, denture wearer. Picture Florence Henderson with slaves.
Oh, God.
This week, for a brief moment, the foul winds of environmental disaster ran aground that Republican garbage scow, affectionately known as the USS Bush, and swirled its frothy squalls of doom up through the lee scuppers and aft into the rat-filled bilge, where brains were once kept in irons and tortured with Texas accents. For there upon that vessel, a mutiny of sorts has occurred against the Bush War on Brains. Over the years, the White House has enlisted numerous moronic arguments for not dealing with reality, in particular, the reality of greenhouse gases, the most urgent industrial waste issue facing humankind since Arnold Schwarzenegger started using latex condoms. Most infamous among these arguments being the felicitudinous theories that the greenhouse effect did not exist at all, and that the Kyoto protocols would encourage abortions on demand.
Come on.
All proven completely false by the world's scientists, except for the abortion parks. Now the White House's own Energy Information Administration, or as no one really calls it, yeah, has released a study directly refuting Bush's last remaining argument against limiting dangerous greenhouse gases, that it would be too expensive and destroy our economy. Kill mendacity. The agency estimated the plan to cut greenhouse gas would cost each U.S. household only $78 per year, or about 5 euros, and would reduce the gross domestic product in 20 years by roughly 0.1%, or about 5 euros. Negligible figures when you account for the fact that Bush has already reduced the gross domestic product at least that much by outsourcing jobs and killing over 1,700 potential American factory workers in Iraq. To be fair, Bush has made some proposals to deal with U.S.-produced greenhouse gases, but unfortunately, they all end with the words Antichrist, Rapture, and Crawford Bunker.
Yeah.
But now, irrefutable evidence from his own agency essentially destroys Bush's last argument against cutting greenhouse gas, leaving him with no other choice. Invade Iran. Shameful. I warn you, it was only a minor victory, freedom fighters. But like they say, good things come in small packages. Speaking of which, I have to go now. I'm late for my abortion.
Oh, God.
And that's today's dispatch from
the War on Brains.
Well, thank you, Mort. That was very engaging, as always. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you again as well, Mark.
Do you have to run to the doctor for real? You're getting an abortion, or was
getting
that
an abortion?
Some sort of sick joke.
It's my right, abortion on demand. Thank God for abortion on demand.
Look, he's got
all for it.
He's got six pack abs, and he's pregnant.
Yeah,
you're an amazing guy.
Unbelievable.
It's all part of the liberal media experience.
Oh, ooh. All right. That sort of.
What is that ooh for? What is this? Like sort of stupid comic?
All right, don't get all worked up.
What the hell is that?
Just try. Go have a good day, will you?
All right, fine.
Get out. Get out, you and your war on brains. We love you, man.
Whatever.
Yeah. A report in London, in the London Independent over the weekend caught our eye. In it, journalist Patrick Coburn reports that U.S. soldiers in Iraq do not report insurgents attacks against them unless there are casualties. This because, quote, our generals want to hear about the number of attacks going down, not up, end quote. Does this jibe with standard military practice? Joining us in the studio right now is Paul Rykoff, founder and director of Operation Truth. He was a first lieutenant and served as an infantry platoon leader in the 3rd Infantry and 1st Armored Division for 1 year in Iraq, and that was ending in February 2004. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Is that standard practice?
No.
It's
that's
not.
That's a quick answer, no.
Okay.
I think it's pretty easy to find a quote or two from a lower-level enlisted guy and make it seem like it's indicative of a larger issue. But the reality is that these guys are facing these types of attacks every day, and there's pretty extensive reporting that does go on.
Okay.
I know when I was there, every time any kind of significant attack took place, that means basically anything above small arms fire. If you record every single attack that took place, you wouldn't have enough paper in Baghdad, because basically every time you leave the compound, you get shot at.
Really?
But doesn't it seem to you that it's falling out of the attention of the news media, and we've got another report here that says that journalists are bunkered in because they're so afraid of kidnapping, and people don't want to necessarily escort journalists, that there
right.
isn't a lot of
I think that's definitely true. Okay. I think that what we've seen, especially in the last 6 to 12 months, is a dramatic pullback in the number of press personnel, the sheer number of press personnel that are in Iraq, and the ones that are there are scared as hell to leave the compound. You know, they say it's too dangerous, they're worried about their heads getting cut off, but at the same time, they give the American public the impression that they're reporting stuff fairly, mm-hmm. which I think is a really, really, you know, insidious part of the whole process.
So you don't see any insidious intent on behalf of the military?
Oh, I think there's enough blame to go around. The military has definitely waged a concerted effort to hide the human cost of this war and the reality of this war. There was a recent report in Salon.com where Mark Benjamin found that the wounded are only coming in at night, and that's a concerted effort on the part of the Pentagon.
Yeah.
To only bring the wounded in at night. We know about the coffins. I mean, look at the New York Times today. It's on page 8, the names of the dead. Mm-hmm. Consistently, the Pentagon and the White House has tried to shield and hide the human cost of this war from the American people, and the media has in part allowed them to do that.
Paul, when we look at what's going on over there, there's been a gradual shift since the election in terms of the U.S. military's role. Apparently, more and more soldiers are training Iraqi security forces. What do you know about how that's going? Are the Iraqi security forces more trustworthy than they were, for example, 6 months ago? Because 6 months ago, a lot of American troops wanted nothing to do with them.
Well, I don't know if they're more trustworthy, but they definitely have progressed. The numbers aren't anywhere near the 150,000 you'll hear out of the Pentagon, because they consider anybody who's learned how to march in the last 3 days a viable soldier, which is just not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I was there. I trained a lot of these guys, and granted, this was about a year ago, but a lot of them are like the bad news bears. I mean, we kicked the hell out of this army, you know, a year and a half ago, and then you try to stand them up and put them back online. It's very difficult. Even getting Shias and Sunnis to work together in a chain of command is incredibly difficult. But we have seen progress in the last month. It's the lowest level of American casualties in 13 months. You have to take that into account. Now, the question is it a lull or is it a pattern? And we don't know yet. I think you've seen on both sides that people want to rush to a judgment every time the numbers move one direction or another. But I think the reality is that we're going to see ebbs and flows, and this is going to be a long process.
But are they still engaging at the same
amount? They're not. They're not. And that's an important shift of tactic. It's actually an evolution. The military is finally getting it. They're trying to shift away from being involved and going out and kicking in doors and making new enemies, and they're trying to transition into what's really become like the Vietnamization that we had in Vietnam. They're bringing in advisors to try to train the Iraqi people and serve as instructors or mentors or teachers and pull themselves back further out of the cities. That's another thing that's happened. A lot of these forward operating bases have been removed from the cities and put into the outskirts, and that has dramatically affected the number of American casualties. But at the same time, the insurgents' tactics have been evolving. You're not seeing as many roadside bombs, but you are seeing bigger, more spectacular, more coordinated attacks,
which is an evolution
on the part of the insurgency also.
Right. I read about this fire truck attack where there were several diversionary tactics to get the main bomb closer to the compound, and that there were perhaps 100 people involved.
Right.
And I read a statement from the military saying that these attacks are so dramatic because the insurgency is losing. They're compromised. Yeah. They're desperate. But that doesn't really seem to make sense to me.
That spin, I really think it is. I mean, what I've seen in my time on the ground was that I saw the insurgency start to develop. They recognize your patterns, they learn your weaknesses, and they evolve. And I think you'll go through times where they do what we'd call in the military consolidating and reorganizing. They'll lay low, they'll build up their forces, they'll train, they'll build a fire truck loaded with bombs, and they'll wait until they're ready to make a spectacular attack. There was also an attack on the anniversary of the war on Abu Ghraib that got relatively no press coverage. That was a coordinated attack with multiple car bombs, that they called them VBIEDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, and small arms fires, small unit tactics. That's definitely an evolution. We did not see that a year and a half ago.
Except for that 40 people were injured in that. 40
right.
Americans, I
right.
know.
They took a guard tower. I mean, it wasn't a resounding success for them, but you can see that they're making progress in some lanes.
How do you separate, particularly when it comes to these kidnappings, which apparently have a lot of American journalists very nervous over there, how do you separate kidnappings by insurgents versus kidnappers who are just out to get money?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And I think that the Pentagon at times will tell you that they know the difference between the two, and I don't think they do. And there's a lot of reasons to want to attack or hate Americans right now. And I think to try to say that we've got a clear understanding of what the profile of the insurgency is wrong. It's just unrealistic. I think at times they've seen trends, but it's a hodgepodge of people. You've got Syrians, you've got Iranians, you've also got people who are broke who are paid a couple thousand to blow up an American. There's not a standard profile. And I think what we have to really look at is what are the political and economic implications that we can impose that can raise the bar for everyone so there are more jobs and a guy's got a pencil or a shovel in his hand instead of an AK.
Right. We're talking to Paul Rykoff. He's the founder of Operation Truth. We're going to come back. I want to talk a little bit about your organization, a little bit about what the pulse and what the feeling and sentiments of the troops on the ground now that you've been in contact with in Iraq and how they're feeling in terms of what they're up against and the evolution of the conflict. It's 44 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
800-801-GAME. That's 1-800-801-GAME. Call now, 1-800-801-GAME.
Forty-nine past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Edition. We're talking to Operation Truth's Paul Rykoff about the organization. For people that don't know, Paul, just explain Operation Truth.
Operation Truth at OperationTruth.com is the country's first and largest Iraq veterans group. We're trying to represent a piece of the discussion that's been missing, that of the people who've actually been on the ground. You hear a lot about who knows what's going on about from four-star generals and policy wonks and reporters and most people who are sitting behind air-conditioned desks in Washington. But you rarely hear from the guys who've been on the ground, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, what is the consensus from the guys on the ground in terms of, like, the lip service being paid to, people are going to be coming home in droves now, that there's we've been marginally victorious over there? What are the guys on the ground?
There is no consensus, and I think that's the first thing we recognize among the guys, is that they come out all over the spectrum. The closest thing we do see to consensus is on a pullout. Most of the guys really don't think that a pullout is the most responsible thing to do and the smartest thing for us to do. Nobody's happy about the rationale for war. Nobody's happy about the Bush doctrine and the way it's going. But at the same time, most of us who've been on the ground think that there is a chance to salvage this thing. It's going to be hard, and we don't know if we're going to get the resources to do it. But an immediate and total pullout is the one thing that guys seem to be pretty united on objecting to, strangely. But
if Paul Rykoff were in charge of the U.S. Central Command in Baghdad, what, if anything, do you think you could do to stop the flow of arms and money to the insurgency?
I think the core problem that we're having in Iraq is that we've never established a security situation. We've never had the place locked down. from the outset. As soon as the looting kicked off and the army was disbanded, we were never able to maintain the borders, control the flow of arms, money, everything else going in and out of the country. And that was
important. Did you have enough troops to do
no,
that?
No, and that's a big reason why. I mean, when we hit the city, I remember going on the top of the Ministry of Finance and looking out over Baghdad, and one of my guys going, "Hey, LT, where the heck is everybody else?" We were wondering the same thing. We expected tons of Red Cross people to come pouring in, humanitarians, and MPs, all these other soldiers to help us lock down every corner, and we never got that.
And that was
so the place became like a sieve.
And that was a bottom line issue with Rumsfeld. He didn't want to spend the money, basically,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, he did it on the cheap, and you know, he thought he was going to be able to do it with a lot of gee whiz gizmos and high tech weaponry, and he forgot about the most important part of an occupation, which is the boots on the ground. And General Shinseki said that it would take, you know, several hundred thousand people to properly secure Iraq, but he got blown off by Wolfowitz, by Rumsfeld, by a lot of guys who've never served in uniform who thought they knew better.
So do you think, you know, and I'd like to know about what the troops' reaction to this is, the guys that you've talked to, that this was not, that this thing was bungled by these guys, that the entire operation from the very beginning in terms of what their vision was and what they planned to do was bungled. It was, there was no plan.
Yeah, I think that's true, and most of us share that understanding, and also kind of a shock that no one's been held accountable. 40,000 guys went into Iraq without body armor. We've heard the stories about Humvees. We've heard the stories about lack of water, lack of training. The National Guard now makes up 45% of the force in Iraq. These guys did not have a plan for what came after the fall of Baghdad. And the most outrageous thing is that no one's been held accountable. We're sitting here talking to Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire about what kind of pills they popped, but we can't have an investigation to get to the bottom of why people didn't have body armor or what Halliburton's doing in Iraq or why our people aren't properly trained to deal with the insurgency.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that has kind of been flying under the radar in the entire Iraq situation is what's going to happen in Kirkuk. It's the fourth largest city in the country. There's a whole bunch of oil sitting underneath it. There are also at least six figures worth of Arabs that the Kurds want out of the city. What do you think, what role, if any, do you think the American military is going to play if that situation comes to a boil?
Well, I think that's what we've seen is that Kirkuk has really become a focal point now. It's kind of shifted away from Fallujah and toward Kirkuk. And the Kurds are really a piece of this puzzle that the American public doesn't hear much about. I mean, most of the guys who've been there will tell you that the Kurdish region is entirely different from the rest of the country. And what most of the guys I've heard from think that will be an independent section unto itself at some point. That's what the Kurds want. They view themselves as different. And Kirkuk is really going to be a critical benchmark for success or failure in Iraq. How Kirkuk goes, I think, is in large part how Iraq goes.
Now, what about the rebuilding effort? We've heard, and we talked about earlier, that a lot of money and manpower is going into training Iraqis, and this is actually money that they had originally put aside for rebuilding the country on some level. But they need to put it into training Iraqis, and now it seems like this insurgency. The one thing that I don't understand how there's any success if they can't get water, sewage things under operation, and even the oil business that was supposed to be up and running is being sabotaged almost weekly by insurgents. So how does that affect the troops in terms of, like, do they see that this is ever going to be resolvable? How long do they think they're going to be there?
I mean, that's a good question, and I don't think anybody has a clear understanding. One of the things you owe everyone as a military commander, whether you're a platoon leader or a general, is a timeline, giving people an understanding of how long you're going to be there and what the plan is. And it's very hard for the average American soldier when we don't know how long we're going to be there. More than half are there now for a second time. And what you're seeing is we really are eating our seed corn. We're using up our military, and the wheels are starting to come off on the all-volunteer force. And the guys are very concerned. You know, they're wondering, how many times am I going to have to go back to Iraq? When are we going to be done there? And we have seen progress at times, but at the same time, you know, we come home to a country that doesn't understand post-traumatic stress disorder or the overextension of our family. And this is part of the reason why we really needed to file an Operation Truth, is because there's such a severe disconnect between the military world and the civilian world. And this is, you know, one of the downsides of the professional army is that there's not really a dialogue between those two groups.
You know, you bring up an important point, because we've been seeing stories here for a while about how recruiting for the armed forces is taking a hit, particularly for the Army. But, I mean, if you were going to grade how returning vets from Iraq, and you're one of them, how they're treated when they get back, not just by the American military and the apparatus, but by the American people, what grade would you give it?
I think the American people have a lot of positive sentiment, and we've been treated very well on a day-to-day basis. And that's in large part, I think, a testament to the Vietnam generation, because they've taught America to separate the warriors from the war. But when it comes to veteran services, I think we're being slapped in the face. The VA budget's underfunded by close to $1 billion for 2006. The Bush administration has made it clear that veterans' issues are not a priority in this country right now. And until they come out and make a statement that they are a priority, it's all lip service. They like to stand up in front of us and have a wall of camouflage for a photo op. But when it comes to funding VA hospitals or creating transitional services, they're nowhere. There was a recent vote on the floor of the Senate about a week or two ago where the Democrats proposed to increase the budget to the VA by $2 billion. It was straight party line. Every Republican voted against it except for one, Arlen Specter.
Wow.
And so people in Washington really support the troops. It's time for them to put their money where their mouth is. And they're going to have a tremendous opportunity in the next couple of months to do that.
So, Paul Rykoff, you're heading out to, we've got an affiliate in Dallas. You're going to be at Texas A&M?
Right. We're going to be at Texas A&M on Thursday night. We're doing a national college tour. We're going to be at Seton Hall in New Jersey next week, John Jay College in New York City in the beginning of the month. And we're doing a barnstorming tour trying to connect people with the guys who've been there.
Now, is this all open to the public?
It is. Everything's open to the public. You can see more of that on our website at OperationTruth.com. We've also got some very important legislation coming down the pipe affecting post-traumatic stress disorder. We need everybody's help in supporting that, and you can find out more information about that on the website as well.
Well, that's great. We've been talking to Paul Rykoff. The organization is Operation Truth. As he said, www.optruth.com. Do you take donations and everything?
Oh,
we
absolutely take them. This organization was built on the kindness of people all around the country. We need everybody's help.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
We're going to come back, and what do we got coming up? We're going to talk more about, let's see.
We're
going to
talk about that FBI threat list and who's on it and who's not.
Yeah, that was wild, man. A lot of Muslims, but no American terrorists, apparently. And it is the That's right, it's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, and of course all of you who are pretty sure that you know more and think more about more things and are just better than everybody else and you're doing the big work in your car. Good morning to you. We have a new Pope, Pope Benedict the 16th, formerly Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. Now, we Cardinal Milfington had a friend who was actually in the Vatican, which was, of course, one of the oldest megachurches. And he was there and he witnessed the process by which they picked the Pope and was actually able to record some of it. And we got this mini disc this morning, and it's pretty powerful. And let's hear that. Can we, Kayla?
Gentlemen, if I may have your attention, please. P as in the Paul, 6. P, 6. Next. O, 15. Oh, you know, like the Old Testament, 15. O, 15. Here she comes, the next ping pong ball. E as in Ecclesiastes, 8.
Hey, I got a Pope there. Everybody, I'm in a new Pope.
Okay, bring up your card, Giuseppe. Let me check your numbers. She's looking good. Oh, we got a new Pope. Somebody drink up the white smoke.
A lot of people didn't realize that they are forced to speak in Chico Marx-like Italian accents.
Bensonhurst, Brooklyn Italian accents.
Sure,
sure,
yeah.
A couple of cases.
Uh-huh, yeah, and even the Ratzinger, who's German, they're all forced to speak like that. Because you would think that, you know, he says, I'm the new Pope. You would think it'd be more of a German, Pope, you know, whatever that, you know.
He speaks 10 languages, apparently, but all with a very thick German accent.
Yeah, exactly. So this might have been one of the 10, which was, you know, Italian-American accent. Is that...
I don't even know if he's ever been... Has he ever been to the States? Can we verify that?
I don't know, Riley. You're asking the wrong guy.
I'm wondering if he's ever been to America and if he plans on coming soon.
Now, my big concern, as it has been all week and as it has been since the beginning of this show, is the Christo-Fascist Zombie Brigade are now in the midst of preparing for one of their biggest events yet. It is the Justice Sunday, April 24th. They're going to hold a conclave, a revival show, a fascist meeting at the Baptist Church in Louisville, Kentucky. We had an emailer say this is not just a church. This is like Six Flags over Jesus. This is a huge mega church. And you know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this before, Riley, in terms of the Vatican, in terms of cathedrals in Italy when I visited Umbria and Tuscany, is that the idea of the mega church, the idea of creating whatever is necessary to have an impact on your followers, is what they do. And they did that then. They would hire the greatest artists, the greatest architects, and they would build these cathedrals in where even if you're not even a religious person, you walk in and you drop down on your knees and go, oh, my God, look at this place. And this is still the dynamic and still the manifesto of these modern churches, only it's a little tackier, a little cheesier, a little more modern, a lot of laser light shows, a lot of bad rock music with bad lyrics, you know, a lot of big video screens. But it's too crazy. Create the same effect. Look how big God can be.
Because what they're trying to say is there's safety in numbers. That we have this big tent, and every Sunday we fill it.
Big tent that excludes Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, secular humanists.
Inferior
atheists,
religions all.
Gay people. I mean, well, that's it. This is going out to 1,000 churches on a satellite simulcast. That's what's going on. People are bringing people into their churches to watch this event. People who will be speaking at this event, Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, James Dobson, founder and chairman of Focus on Family, Al Mohler, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This is their big movement, their big sort of revival meeting to try to characterize the Democrats and the people within the judiciary as being anti-Christian. Now, this is, from where I'm standing, what they're doing is anti-American, it's anti-constitutional, it's anti-American government. What is worse, to be anti-Christian or to be anti-American? And if you're a Republican or a Christian that isn't a hypocristian, which is some a slang term that I got from an emailer. Thank you. I like it. How do you accept that you align yourself with this, you know, renegade vision, this fascist contingency within the Republican Party, within this country, that is trying to encourage violence against members of the judiciary? Now, let us not forget that on some level, people like Timothy McVeigh, people like Eric Rudolph,
yes,
these are people that align themselves with the same ideology of the people that are meeting at the megachurch for Justice Sunday. They may not be dispatched by the megachurch people. Dobson may not say go out and kill people, but these are people with the same ideology. Norm Olson of the Michigan Militia put a reach-out call to all the militias nationwide to take a military action on behalf of the Christian right to kidnap Terri Schiavo before she died and put her in a safe house. This is a military, you know, a pseudo-military, a militia that is willing to align themselves with this renegade strand of republicanism, or they're calling it republicanism, but it's really the Christo-fascist zombie brigades who are, you know, they are want to overthrow the U.S. government, and they have armed people that are willing to do their bidding. Isn't that? Can I make that jump?
Sure, you can make that jump. And the saddest part of all, Mark, is that they stole a progressive frame to do it. For years, there's been something called Social Justice Sunday. This has been an effort by progressive clergy people to come together around issues like the death penalty and social justice issues. A lot of the same things that are driving the liberation theology of the Catholic Church. So what do? They just drop the social part and they call it Justice Sunday. And some people, if you go up on the Internet and look for this sort of thing, they're commingled together, Justice Sunday and Social Justice Sunday. But this is also the rise of this sort of evangelical media. Mark, one day I was walking across town not far from here, and I went past Madison Square Garden, which usually they have basketball games.
Mm-hmm.
There was this big religious revival that was going on there. And the thing that struck me right off the top was for the first time I saw those big tractor trailers that they used to broadcast sporting events or they used to broadcast. We saw them during the convention. They were all there. They were all bought and paid for by this one televangelist. And suddenly you start realizing these people are using the tools of technology that we all take for granted. We use them for PlayStations. We use it for this. We use it for that. But they are using this technology now. And that's what they're doing with this Justice Sunday. They beam it out to all of these different churches across the country. And what it has the effect of doing is a modern-day version of circling the wagons.
Sure. And also, but they're, more than that, too, Riley, they're using networks within publishing. They're using networks within within grassroots organizations. They're putting out books that are actual revisionary books, you know, mischaracterizing the history of this country as something that it wasn't, in order to make people who don't think. The scariest thing to me is that they are going to, this is something that Tony Perkins says, quote, we must communicate to people of faith across this country that this is a filibuster of people of faith, as he's talking about the judicial nomination, that the courts are consistently taking away the religious liberties of Christians in particular and people of faith in general in this nation. And then this article that I'm reading from Rob Garver in the American Prospect, he cites that, you know, he quotes Perkins as saying, we're going to hold our fire, and then we begin to just pound the United States Senate with phone calls and faxes telling them to stop filibustering people of faith and vote up or down on the president's judicial nominees. We have to get the Christians of this country, people of faith, to understand that this is an issue, this is a battle they cannot miss, end quote. But what they do to characterize this battle is they take these people that may not be very intelligent, that may not have a sense of what history is, that may not understand why the separation of church and state is necessary to make democracy function properly and to make this country the amazing country that it is, and they brainwash them. They put the psychic screws into them with all this, lights and laser shows and community activism. But
you know what can stop it in its tracks, though? See, here's the problem. A lot of people don't have access to the information about all this, that you're only talking about 10 judges out of 214. See, if you put it in the context they're filibustering people of faith, then that puts it in one frame. But when you start talking about the fact, as Bill Clinton very correctly pointed out, we're talking about 10 judges versus 40 that were stymied during his administration by the Republicans, there's no comparison here.
But the Christo Fascist Zombie Brigade has to be stopped, and they're going to be flooding Senate offices with form letters because these people don't think, they follow. And they follow these leaders, Dobson, Perkins, they follow them. They just let them dump into their head, and they follow them, without questioning anything. And these people are trying to rewrite the history of the United States and get rid of the Constitution. They're anti-American. Is it worse to be anti-Christian or anti-American? Are these the good Americans? Are you a good American like the Germans were good Germans who just think that this isn't really a threat to you? I think it is. Call us. Where do you stand? 866-303-2270. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about the FBI report that doesn't even cite American terrorism as being an issue. In the wake of Oklahoma City, which was anniversary this week, and in the wake of the Eric Rudolph trial, it doesn't even cite American terrorists as being a threat. Now, what is that about? 17 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow, yes, yes, I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah, drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay, well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
An optometrist regularly, they're like early warning systems for your eyes.
Your eyes deserve an optometrist.
Going past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Going to clear some stuff up. It seems that we have two reports, domestic terrorism reports, one from the FBI, one from the Department of Homeland Security. The FBI does talk about the Aryan Nations, but that limits their discussion of, homegrown terrorism to that. And it seems that the Department of Homeland Security report talks about homegrown terrorism in terms of ecology militants and certain in members of animal rights organizations, without putting much indication that there is a domestic homegrown Christian terrorist potential. Neither one of them really talk about that. And we are going to talk to our associate producer, Dan Pashman, our editorial producer, here in just a second, and he wrote an article for BuzzFlash about this very topic. But first, like right now, You know, it's hard to figure out what the headlines are trying to say exactly when from the mainstream media. So luckily we've got this iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank this thing up. Here we go. All right. Here we go from the New York Times. German cardinal is chosen as new pope. Let's feed that in there. German cardinal is chosen as new pope. Translation. Ex-Hitler youth pulls self up by jackboot straps. From USA Today, Bolton vote delayed. Throw that in there. Bolton vote delayed. Here's a translation. Confirmation hearings take surprise turn into relevance. From the Associated Press, body part thief gets more than 2 years. Body part thief gets more than 2 years. Translation. Feet fingered, caught red-handed, received stiff sentence. Oh, come on. So Dan Pashman is in the room with us. Mark Riley is here. It's always been my speculation that there is that really the groups that are going to be meeting, these church groups that are supported by Tom DeLay, Dobson's group, Focus on Family, the Family Research Council, all these groups are really barely a stone's throw away from having an active military arm, an active violent outreach program. There are certainly people like Eric Rudolph is aligned himself with the Army of God.
Army of God.
This type of Christian militancy, this type of Christian terrorist is not really talked about, but there's a very weird gray area between the militia movement, the Aryan Nation movement, and the Christian terrorist movement. Am I right, Dan?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Mark. And like you say, this group, Army of God, has Eric Rudolph is not the only person associated with this group. Who has a history of violence. There's a man named William Krar who was arrested a couple of years ago, also a member of the Army of God. They found 60 pipe bombs in this guy's basement, 60 pipe bombs in his basement. And when he was arrested, you would think that this was back before the election. The Bush administration back then was jumping on any chance they could to remind Americans that they were keeping us all safer back at that time. You would think they found a guy with 60 pipe bombs in his basement in America. This isn't halfway across the world. In America, you'd think that they would trot this guy out, make a huge deal of it.
And not just say things like, wow, did you make these yourself? Did you get your equipment from Bob down there?
Exactly.
Down the hardware store?
Because actually, we can put you in touch with the guys who go way better.
We got a guy that used to work for us could help you
right,
out.
Right, exactly. And they didn't say a word about that guy. And Eric Rudolph has come and gone as, yes, he's a bomber. But the fact that this guy is a right-wing militant with a far right-wing agenda, where was President Bush? Where was he stepping forward, to make a big deal out of this?
And it's interesting, in the Department of Homeland Security list of terrorist threats within this country, that there is no mention of the Army of God. There's very little mention of any of that type of domestic terrorism. And this is the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, which killed 168 people. And people like Timothy McVeigh, was aligned with some of these, briefly, maybe, but he was aligned with some of the white supremacist groups, some of the right-wing militia groups. It just seems to me that there's a real gray area there. Like, I was very surprised with Norm Olson, Michigan militia guy. These are usually sort of, marginal, kind of live off the grid, we don't want to pay taxes type of people, but when he made an offer to bring militias together to kidnap Terry Schiavo, I realized that, when somebody like Tom DeLay or somebody like Senator John Cornyn says something like, these judges, might be a problem, and I wouldn't be surprised if something bad happens, that
exactly.
There's a lot of people willing to take that action.
Well, see, this is where people have to connect the dots, because there are going to be some parishioners that are going to go to their churches and see this Justice Sunday stuff and think, and take it at face value, and they don't know of the connections between a lot of these folks and these terrorists that are out here, these domestic terrorists, because that's what Oklahoma City was.
866-303-2270. I know a lot of you think that this is a minority, that these aren't all Christians, and they're not, and they don't represent America, but, how many original Nazis were there? Really? I mean, where does this stuff start? I know it can't happen here. It can't happen here, right? There's no place like home.
Oh, see, I knew you were going, Dorothy. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. I'm selling, underwear on Orchard Street in the middle of August all day. You know, hey!
Randy Rose on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's morning tradition. We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Is fascism upon us? Is it worse to be anti-Christian or anti-American, like some of these Christian groups claim to be? They claim to be pro-American. They claim to be true Americans. But I think a lot of them are just the good Americans, not unlike the good Germans. But let's talk about that. Who we got on the phone there, Chris?
Hey, Mark, we have Future Mark on line one.
Future Mark, awesome.
Put me through to me.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
So what's going on 50 years from now, today?
I'm calling you from work, man. We don't sweep anymore. There's only work. Work is strength. Work is the way.
Dude, you don't sound like myself.
I know, man, but they're listening. All right, okay, they're gone.
So they really keep you at it in the year 2050, huh?
It's brutal. You know why, right?
No, why?
It's debt, man. Because of our enormous credit card debt, I'm clocking 24/7 at the MBNA mining colony on the moon.
The moon? Cool.
No, it's not, man. It's like a bunch of cubicles linked together. Fluorescent lighting. They won't even let me have a ficus. Uses too much oxygen, they say.
So wait, man. How did we get into so much debt?
Well, that's why I'm calling you, buddy. You remember that lunch you bought on May 7, 2003 with that Capital One Visa? The one with the $300 limit?
No. No, I don't remember that.
Well, I do, man. You threw the card in your desk and you never paid the bill. Then 4 years ago, two DOD agents show up at my door.
Department of Defense?
Department of Debt. And they said I owe $340,000 on that Capital One card. Pay now or it's off to debt camp.
Wow. Did I ruin your life?
Not really. Pretty much everyone's here with me. People only go back to Earth for credit counseling or debt consolidation appointments. It's pretty good anyway.
Wait, so you work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Oh, I forgot to tell you, buddy. Now there are 43 hours in a day, and there are 13 days a week. They got rid of the Roman calendar after the Discover Card riots of 2022.
Oh, sorry. All right, I'll try to find that card. Wait, is everything else all right? Is there anything else I should know?
Yes. This is important. Okay, so listen. In a couple of years, your wife, Mishna, is going to ask you, do you like the green or the blue? Whatever you do, man, say green. Okay, so trust me, buddy. You will so thank me for this.
Green. Gotcha.
Just keep saying it. Green. Also, stop eating beets, okay? Just get used to not eating them. The current president outlawed them along with stuffed animals and caramel.
What is he, crazy?
Can't talk now. Work is strength. Work is the way. I'll call you next week.
Wow, man. It's going to be scary in the future.
So work is strength. Work is strength.
Here we go. Lila in Westchester listening to LIB. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. What's going on, Lila? What's on your mind?
I just wanted to first say how much I love you guys. I just got turned on to you guys about 3 weeks ago, and you're fabulous.
Thank you.
But I am a little disturbed by your comment about is it better to be a better American, a good American, or a good Christian?
Oh, anti-American or anti-Christian.
Because I do feel that you're alienating a lot of people of faith that are liberal in inclination. And I remember a few weeks ago you guys had commented, you know, what we need is a march on Washington with progressive people of faith. And I feel like that's a more appropriate attack to this kind of, you know, taking over the Christian faith that I feel is taking place.
Okay.
Rather than alienating people with two types of faith that I think might make them feel like, I don't want to choose.
Yeah, it was meant to be a provocative question, but I appreciate it and I understand what you're saying. That when I'm saying anti-Christian or anti-American is that I believe that this strand of Christianity, this fascist strand of Christianity that is trying to attack the one branch of government that hasn't been infiltrated by them and as efficiently as the other ones, you have to realize that this type of religiosity, this type of Christo-fascism has never been so in the government. They are part of the government now. So they've never had this kind of power. And the reason I'm saying anti-Christian or anti-American is I believe that these people, the Dobsons, the Perkins, and what they represent is anti-American. And they're accusing us of being anti-Christian, which we're not. But the question is meant to be a provocative one, not meant to alienate people of faith, which I think we'll find.
Yeah, well, you know, at the root of all this, Mark, is the one thing that Ratzinger said prior to his elevation to the papacy, the idea that the Catholic religion is better than anybody else's. And at the root of what we see here with too many of the Christian right is the base notion that they know better, that they know who God is, they know who Jesus is, and Buddhism and any other religion that is found on this planet is inherently inferior to their view.
I think that they are inherently a political movement. I think that Dobson and Perkins, that these guys are very clear that this is about consolidating power. I think you read a lot of this stuff, they barely mention Jesus in some of these churches.
But see, the thing is, it all flows from this. It's not just about Jesus.
Right.
It's about the idea that their Christianity is the best Christianity.
Although I would argue that pretty much since the dawn of time, those who have gone with the my God's better than your God approach to governing have always been people who are more concerned about consolidating power than about serving Jesus or whoever that God may
be. Well, the thing is that the anti-American thing is that this country is built on the idea the reason there is a separation of church and state is so everybody can practice the religion of their choice or not. And we exist as the most important thing as Americans. That's what this country was built on. That's why it works so beautifully. It was put there, the separation of church and state was put there to protect religious freedom.
I agree, Mark, but, you know, I had a professor at Tufts University who said, you know, the Puritans left England, came to America fleeing religious persecution,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
8 years after they arrived, they hung their first Quaker on Boston Common.
But that's, you don't know, the human heart is a dark place, man. I'm watching Hotel Rwanda at home. My biggest concern is that you have Republicans out there, moderate Republicans, perhaps atheist Republicans, you know, secular Republicans, who you ask them, well, what about this faction within your party that is clearly, you know, Christo fascist, that is clearly wants to take over the country and make it a theocracy? They're like, yeah, come on.
Right.
Yeah, that's what the Germans said. That's what, you know, that's what some of the Hutu said in Rwanda. They were like, they're not really going to do that. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you're watching your neighbor getting cut up. You know, all right, I'm getting worked up. John, what's going on, John? How are you in Atlanta?
Hey, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to say first, as a person who's 100% American and an atheist, I don't consider myself anti-Christian, but I don't believe that there's a magic ghost in the sky that listens to everything that goes through my head.
Uh-huh.
And the last caller, one of the last callers that you had, talked about alienating people of faith within the Democratic Party. Well, it appears to me that a lot of people in the Democratic Party, since the Republicans have claimed faith on their side, the Democrats seem to be scrambling to try to say, no, we're good Christians too. We're good Christians too.
Right.
Well, we're not all good Christians, and I'm tired of being lumped into the same kind of group. You know, I
think you're right, and I think it's going to be a big mistake on part of some of the Democrats, because I think it reeks of assimilation, of trying to pass. And I think that to me is one of the first indications that we're going to get plowed under in the worst way by people that they it shows no core values. Thank you.
Right.
There is no center. Okay, here we go. What are we talking to? Leah in Florida. How are you, Leah?
Hi.
Oh, golly, I'm sick. Your New York illness has moved down to Florida here.
What do you mean?
So,
the bug. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the froggy bug where you cough. And.
Yeah, it was going around up here. I guess someone brought it down there special in their luggage.
Yeah, I think they did.
What's on your mind?
To my house.
Oh. Yeah, okay. It wasn't my fault.
What I called about was not that. I called because for a year I've been thinking fascism, this is fascism, this is fascism. And I didn't hear anybody saying that. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm wrong. And I was afraid to say it.
Yeah, well, people condescend to that word. Liberals are like, are you really going to use that word? Why not?
Yeah, because that's what it is.
Yeah, I know.
And that's what ended up happening. And then I hear these fascist senators and old Tom DeLay threatening judges. If I did that, I would be put in jail.
Yeah.
You know, the Patriot Act, I'd be just disappeared, I guess.
Well, we tried to get him put in jail. We called the CIA last week when they had the JCCCR down there in Washington. But I appreciate your sentiments, and so you don't have to feel alone anymore, Leah.
Oh, I don't. I like your show.
Okay, thanks. We'll feel better. Okay.
Okay, I will.
Okay, right. Bye bye. I've gotten that too. You know, from a sort of like, you know, the horn rimmed glasses wearing windbreaker crowd of, you know, postmodern hipsters that you have so much contempt for. I myself have a bit of contempt for as well, Dan Pashman. When you say fascism, they're like fascism. I mean,
yeah,
really?
Isn't that a little harsh? But you know what's interesting, Mark, and I think you've made this point in the past, is that when someone on the far, or someone on the right wing uses language that could be perceived as inflammatory to describe the left, there are no right wing moderates who are like, really, you really think that? You know, they either turn a blind eye to that kind of extremism entirely, or they implicitly support it. And fascist is not an extreme word to describe this administration. And you know, that, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, that's a point that we have proven ad infinitum.
A fascist is one whose lust for money or power is combined with such an intensity of intolerance towards those of other races, parties, classes, religions, cultures, regions, or nations as to make him ruthless in his use of deceit or violence to attain his ends. The supreme god of a fascist to which his ends are directed may be money or power, may be a race or a class, may be a military clique or an economic group, or maybe a culture, religion, or political party. The Danger of American Fascism by Henry A. Wallace. We're going to take more calls. It seems to have some legs here. 866-303-2270. It's 44 past the hour. Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
That's cabinet refacing from Sears Home Services. 1-800-828-1200. That's 1-800-828-1200.
Forty-nine past the hour. Let's land this thing. It's Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Hi.
The show is Morning Sedition, right? On Air America Radio.
There you go.
Dan Pashman, Lewis and Linda Pashman, author of a piece on Buzzflash this week. Kalo's in the house. We're talking about the threat and the horror of a one-party rule, of a totalitarian situation, of fascism in this country. I just read a little snippet from Henry A. Wallace, The Danger of American Fascism. Henry A. Wallace was the vice president to Harry Truman, and he ran for president. Am I right, Riley?
He ran in 1948. It's a very interesting tale, which we don't have time to get into too much here. But Henry Wallace was actually, you know, and I guess at the time considered ultra-liberal. He was accused of making common cause with communists and socialists and was himself accused of being anti-American.
There you go. And listen to this, another quote. The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With the fascists, the problem is never how best to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or more power. Go to wallbuilder.com. See, I think Dan Barton, is that the guy's name, the Republican operative?
Yeah.
He's a revisionist. They're writing textbooks, people, that are rewriting American history from the Christo-fascist perspective. They're putting this broadcast, this satellite simulcast, out to 1,000 churches this Sunday. They are accusing the judiciary of the United States of America of being anti-Christian. They are, as if I can, you know, quote Henry Wallace, they are poisoning the channels of public information. It's scary, man. Let's take another call. Joanne, listening in Florida. How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
What's happening? Thinking, Sinclair Lewis was a great American author, and he wrote a book after World War II, I'm not sure of the year, called It Can't Happen Here, telling exactly how, step by step, it can happen here. And it seems to me we're going along those lines. And I think that somebody ought to make a movie out of that book. Go back to when he wrote it. It was a great book. And just read the book by Sinclair Lewis.
Okay.
And it tells you how it can happen here.
Great recommendation. I picked up that book, but I haven't read it. I'm going to read it. It can happen. Philip, thank you for your recommendation. Philip Roth wrote The Plot Against America, which pictures an America, you know, as if Charles Lindbergh won the presidential election against who was it? FDR.
Yeah.
It was a beautifully written book. It deals specifically with that time frame, but nonetheless, it portrays an American fascist country briefly. But it shows how easily it can really happen, and you see that in a movie like Hotel Rwanda. Is that you don't really know what human beings are capable of in large groups or mobilized in a certain way. You think that people are decent people and everyone goes about their lives, but the horrors and atrocities and repression that people are capable of and violence is just, it's baffling if you look at history.
It's true, Mark. And I think that, you know, going along with that, it can't happen here mentality. First of all, one mentality that these types of people rely upon is that innocence and blindness, saying it couldn't happen here. I think it's important to remember, here we are, the year 2005. It was 40 years ago that black people couldn't drink at the same water fountains as white people in America.
Mm-hmm.
It was not that long before that the Japanese people were locked up in internment camps in America.
Mm-hmm.
We are not that far removed from these types of actions, and we are not that far away from getting right back to that point again.
That's absolutely true, and it's only been like 30, like almost 50 years. Before 50 years ago, there was no rock and roll.
Hey,
that was a dark time.
Hey, impossible. Yeah. Hey, before we go, there is something I want to mention. We're going to take another call for.
No,
well, I just want to mark the passing of a legend of basketball coaches, certainly as far as black basketball coaches, Clarence Big House Gaines, a man who was nicknamed because people looked at him and said he was big as a house. He was 6'4", he was 250 pounds. He won 828 basketball games coaching the Winston-Salem University in North Carolina from 1946 to 1993. He was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. His most famous player was Earl of Pearl Monroe, who starred for that team during the 1960s. Extraordinary man, a man who took tough love to a different level as far as making his players stay in school and making his players out to be good and productive human beings no matter what they did after college.
Wow, and how old was he?
81.
81 years old. He had a good run.
Oh, yeah, he had an extraordinary run, and he was a guy. You know, Earl Monroe was getting ready to leave Winston-Salem State, and Big House Gaines said to him, "What are you here for?" And Earl Monroe said, "I'm here to play basketball." He said, "No, you're not. You're here to get an education." If only basketball coaches would be saying that today.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Riley. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. And, you know, I'll tell you something. If you're listening to this show, and this isn't the type of information that interests you, if you think that the evangelical, Christo-fascist, zombie brigade movement is something that is beneath us to talk to or it's not that important, then, you know, you're listening to the wrong show. Because the truth of the matter is that, you know, we get emails sometimes and people are uptight about, or they get mad that we don't cover things thoroughly enough, or they get mad that, you know, maybe we don't cover certain elements of the government that they want, or they get mad at me for BSing. But, you know, this is really the agenda of our show on some level is to sort of speculate along these lines and to try to, because we were talking about this over a year ago. And there was some, you know, there was some movement that said maybe you shouldn't talk about religion so much. Maybe you're hitting that too much. But now it is all over the place. It is clear what's going on. It is clear that there is a fascist attack emanating and beginning within this country, and that people should be aware of it, that these people are anti-American, that the people that are aligned with Tom DeLay, with John Cornyn, with, you know, and that these old school pillage and kill Republicans, you know, the fiscal conservatives, whether they know it or not, and I imagine they do, have aligned themselves with an extremist bunch of people. And I think we need to talk about it, and that's what I'm going to say today.
Well, we have to talk about it because, you know, it is necessary.
I think so, and I appreciate that you're on board with that. Are you okay with that, Fashion?
Absolutely.
All right, here's the liberal agenda for today. From the Streisand compound, one, sue the Vatican for your ingestion of secondhand pipe-electing smoke. Two, propose that the 2012 Olympics be held in cyberspace. No potential host city's feelings will get hurt, and it's so much better for the environment. Three, praise government for getting rid of the new food pyramid because that glorified slave-built monument.
Ooh.
Plus, it's rainbow-colored. But I thought that was a good thing, the rainbow. Five, go to the steps of the new Lincoln Museum and shout, Abe was the last Eastern Republican president, and he was way gayer than Reagan. 5. Today's phrase, just drop this in the conversation. Hey, Senate, nice going on delaying the Bolton confirmation. Too bad you didn't have any nads when it came to confirming Condi or Gonzalez or anyone else from the neocon death cult. Wake up, sheeple. The horse is out of the barn, man.
Hey, man, tomorrow we got some show for you. We've got the final edition of Morning Seditions Radio Theater, starring Mark Maron, Harriet Mantel, News Daddy, you name it, we got it. Plus, Johnny K Street joins us.
Yeah.
Back by popular demand. Here tomorrow morning. Maron, it's been a good show.
Has been, Riley. See you tomorrow.
Have a good one. This is Air America Radio. Good work, patrons.
Thank you.